I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Before its recent release, Scannán caught up with director Brendan J. Byrne to talk about his new Irish documentary, Bobby Sands' 66 Days.
So, yeah, you've been bringing your film everywhere so far. I mean, Toronto to start with must have been amazing.
It was fantastic. I have a good relationship with that city. I've got cousins in it, and I've been to Hot Docs the last 3 years in a row. I had a film at TIFF once. So with just the timing of when we had completed the film, it was the first major festival in view, so to speak. So we applied to there, and we got selected, which was fantastic, because we're in Special Presentations, which is their kind of top sidebar, for want of a better word. And it was great to be there with a film rather than be at the pitching forum and having meetings. So Toronto was great. We had a great opening night world premiere in TIFF Bell Lightbox, which is a fantastic building right in the centre of downtown Toronto, and a great Q&A. And then on the second screening on the 35th anniversary of Bobby Sands' death, the Q&A got a bit rowdy because, you know, Toronto's a town full of Irish people, and built on, in many ways, Presbyterian foundations rather than Irish Catholic foundations. So there was a couple of voices in the auditorium which were a bit more hostile to the film than I was expecting, but it then prepared me for
bringing it closer to home.
You know.
And then Sheffield followed after that.
Sheffield was great. I suppose one of the things that was brilliant in both places was that Nick Fraser, the editor of Storyville, introduced the film in both venues. And that was a huge honour because he's such a big name and legend in the kind of world of documentary film. So he made a mini speech in both places, in Sheffield perhaps more than Toronto to a certain extent, but even more significant because of the kind of huge status he has in the UK. So those screenings in Sheffield were also great. It was 2 days in Sheffield, and the screenings were on the Monday and the Tuesday, and it was really great to see it in an audience. There was quite a number of young Northern Irish students who were studying at Sheffield University and who happened to come and see it, and some of whom were from a Protestant background, and they were very taken with the film because they'd grown up with one narrative, and it was maybe a slightly black and white narrative, and here they were hearing about someone who was probably vilified and a cause that was vilified in our community, but they were kind of drawn to it and enjoyed the film, and it kind of enriched their understanding of where they came from.
Yeah, that's one of the things about the film. Because coming from the South, I had no and being born after his death, I had no experience of that, of what Northern Ireland was like during the 80s or the 70s. And it seems to be quite well balanced in terms of, it doesn't portray him as an out-and-out Republican figure that you'd want, you know, as a recruitment video for the IRA, essentially, which is what you don't want it to be. So that's admirable. Was that something that you had to plan from the outset, that you didn't want it to be?
It could never have been a flag waver for the IRA, because that's not what I would want to do anyway as a filmmaker. But, you know, you're immediately, if you do something like that, going to alienate a part of the community, and even the international community, who are much more sophisticated and can see through these things. That would be simply propaganda, you know. And, you know, the IRA were themselves experts in propaganda and Sinn Féin. So, no, but I was interested in Bobby Sands, and I did find him, through the film, a sympathetic character. But in terms of rounding out the film and contextualising the film, it had to be balanced. You had to put in those voices that made sense of the conflict to people from outside of it who had no experience of it, and to give it nuance for those people who had an awful lot of experience of it. And you couldn't do it in a way whereby you were going to alienate or insult them. So the film has elements of balance in it, but in where there's balance, I think it brings also the drama. So when you have Paisley in there, it's not just bringing somebody up and somebody's voice up trying to say, well, you know, and giving a kind of rounded opinion. You know, he comes in at a point whereby that kind of booming, resonant voice tells the audience that over and above this kind of this idealism called republicanism, you have a reverse and ideologically opposed ideology called unionism, but it comes to, as I say, in a dramatic form. Similarly, when you have a protest outside the prison where Bobby Sands was having his hunger strike later on in the film, you have the then Peter Robinson, who's not long having stepped down from being First Minister of Northern Ireland, and he's obviously presenting a very different view outside the prison to what Bobby Sands is essentially dying for inside the prison. So in both of those moments of balance, there's drama, and there are other voices within the film, including Fintan O'Toole, who are given a sense of the Irish context over and above the Republican context, and obviously others giving the Unionist British context.
Having Martin McCann then as kind of like the voice of Bobby through his diary is a nice touch, because it gives you some insight into the character of Bobby himself, because invariably his entire adult life was in jail. He didn't get out.
He spent a third of his life in jail.
Yeah.
The most important years of adulthood, in fact his only years of adulthood, you know, into jail when he was 18. So essentially, you know, only his teenagers, early and late teenage years, you know, were on the outside. They were on the outside in the tumult of early conflict. So, you know, I knew the diary was going to be central to the film, because in the diary, you know, you have Sands in his own words, and everywhere else is kind of him on a gable wall and other people writing about him. So I wanted to make that central to the film. I'd worked with Martin McCann a good few times before. He was a West Belfast boy himself. I didn't want an actor's voice. And Marty gave it a kind of understated authenticity, I think. So I was very keen to have Marty. And I think that thread of Sands' diary and through the film really provides it with its overall kind of uniqueness and its individual kind of signature.
Yeah, which is something that as a documentary, it's been depicted twice already in fiction, so it's nice to see a documentary take on the life of Bobby Sands.
Because, for sure.
But did you feel that the shadow of hunger or as some other son there?
A little bit, only in the sense that, I mean, I really liked the movie Hunger. I thought it was a smashing piece of work. But obviously the director there was more interested in exploring someone like Bobby Sands. Obviously it was based on Bobby Sands, but in essence it could have been any of the other 10 hunger strikers, because the experiential journey of someone starving themselves to death for something they believed in, that's what Steve McQueen was interested in. So that could have been equally explored through any of the 10. But in the same breath, that film, whilst I admired it immensely, for me it provided and kind of revealed it a narrative deficit in the Bobby Sands story, because I wasn't any more aware of who Bobby Sands was, the man. You know, what politicised him? Why was it Bobby Sands? Why was he a writer? Why did he decide to go on the second hunger strike? Why did he decide to join the IRA? What was his story? So I was amazed when I really started thinking about it, to think that a film, a documentary film, concentrating on the factual side of his life had never been attempted before for someone who's so well known, and in Irish terms, perhaps the most significant political figure in the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. He was an enigma too. He's everyone else projected their own beliefs onto him, essentially, and so this offers us a window into Bobby Sands the person, rather than Bobby Sands the political figure.
Very much so, and that was my intention with the film. And actually, at one point in the early stages of development, I had planned to interview Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender, because I was interested in what drew Steve McQueen to the film, and then I was interested in asking Michael Fassbender about, you know, the whole getting into character and all of that. But I realised in the end I chose not to interview them, because with them in the film, it would just feel too much like Hunger, or Hunger, whatever, everybody would think of Hunger as soon as they came up.
Yeah.
So I then consciously chose not to include them or not to interview them, and in a sense to create some clear blue water. Obviously, comparisons have since been made, but really to point out what you've been saying is that, you know, Sands has been depicted in some form or another in previous fiction film work, but never in a documentary work.
Yeah.
And when most of the reviews that have been written, the other two films have been acknowledged.
Yeah, because, well, there is no escaping the fact that they are out there. They're in, especially Hunger is in the zeitgeist because it is so recent. You know, but it's still, it's 35 years later, it's still an important story. Its impact on Northern Ireland is still felt.
Undoubtedly. You know, and now there's a myriad of different people trying to claim Bobby Sands. You know, that without Bobby Sands, there wouldn't have been a peace process. Without Bobby Sands, there wouldn't have been the re-emergence of Sinn Féin. You could say without Bobby Sands, there wouldn't be dissident Republicans. You know, in the sense that dissident Republicans claim the memory of Bobby Sands as being someone who was a true Irish patriot and a true Republican. And they believe that, you know, mainstream Republicanism in the form of Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams has kind of abused the memory of Bobby Sands by getting into mainstream politics. Now, you know, nobody knows what Bobby Sands himself would have thought, you know, because he's dead. But nonetheless, he remains a potent symbol within Republicanism and someone whose identity and ideals all sides and shades of Republicanism try to claim.
Yeah, and did you feel then that it was important to get this story out while there's still people around that were contemporaries of his?
Yes, always with a film like this, you know, especially with the subject themselves not being alive, you know, the first and best testimony are from the people who knew him best. You know, Bobby Sands, if he had lived, would only have been, you know, 60 as we speak. So his contemporaries are in and around that age. You know, there are, you know, other examples of Second World War films where the testimonies from 80-year-olds. So, you know, in theory, the story can be told for another 10 or 15 years. But I think 35 years after his death and perhaps 15 years since the kind of, you know, solidification of the peace process felt like a reasonable amount of time and a decent amount of distance for a more kind of sober and thoughtful reflection and examination of who he was, and more importantly, a time when the both traditions would be more receptive potentially to looking at the story in a way, in a more balanced way themselves, rather than bring their own prejudices into the cinema. So, you know, this undoubtedly will be a film that some people will ridicule and rubbish before they even see it. But I made it specifically, you know, for younger people, for my kids, and also for to challenge both people within my tradition and people within the Unionist British tradition to say that, you know, all of these IRA guys and all of these hunger strikers can't be easily compartmentalised into being, you know, pawns and good for nothing murdering individuals. You know, there were young, idealistic people who got swept up in a political movement at a time when their community was being oppressed, and they became politicised through a history of in prison, and they felt they were fighting an enemy. So I'm keen for, you know, whilst it not me not setting out to make a history lesson, but that there's challenges and there's interesting material in there for both communities to absorb and reflect on.
Yeah, it's to show how somebody can become radicalized is an important lesson for, especially for the younger generation who've grown up now without that shadow of the troubles lying over them. Because you have an entire adult generation in Northern Ireland now that came of age post the peace process. So don't realize what that was. Their parents do, but and will have implemented on, but it is, until you see it, you won't really understand it.
And that's what I'm fascinated about, and that's why, you know, I've been hearing trickles of my own children's opinions of it, haven't seen it for the first time there in Galway at the weekend, and, you know, fascinating, you know, insights from them and questions from them, and really it is about that generation who would love to go and see the film, young 20-year-olds in Dublin, Belfast, 30-year-olds, people who grew up with no sense of what that was, because I think that's a fascinating story, irrespective of their political opinions, a fascinating story, and it's a sense in which, you know, the archive, it kind of feels like South America, you know, there's a kind of intoxication of the kind of streets, and you kind of think to yourself, in my case, I think that I lived through that. Was I there? And younger people could say, did that happen in Ireland? Are you serious? We're only used to that happening in the Middle East, or, you know, or Turkey, or Cairo, or Egypt, or Syria. You know, that was near the Titanic Visitor Center, or near the Giant's Causeway. That was happening there. It was marches outside the GPO, you know. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how all shades of Irish opinion, you know, respond to it now when it eventually gets more wider visibility, you know, in August when it's released.
Yeah, and to a wider audience, it has parallels with what we see with ISIS and that the radicalization of youth movements in other regions in the world.
For sure. I'm a bit nervous about, you know, drawing too many parallels, other than, you know, I know this story well. What's happening with ISIS and you know, suicide bombers, and it's. I'm not saying there's no links at all, but I couldn't. I'm not saying either that, you know, kind of history is repeating itself. You know, it's a slightly more complicated argument. I do know that, you know, what part of what ISIS is informed by and politicized by is the extent to which whatever oppression they feel is being delivered on their doorstep, much of it is happening beyond the glare of the media. You know, there's tiny towns and villages all across the Middle East which are at the mercy of American military operations, and those stories are not the stories that are being repeated in the mainstream European and international press. So I think that builds a huge amount of resentment. But I'm not remotely in favour, and nor was I in favour of the IRA's actions. But, you know, I think ISIS, you know, as a political ideology, I can't fully understand what they stand for, and only I think their fervent supporters really do appreciate and understand what they do. To me, it just looks like kind of blatant carnage.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was, I love the use of music, or the way that the music is used here, and the animation, okay, the animate sequence as well. What made you choose to do the animation?
Well, I was thinking to myself, we don't have the central character. There's no archive of him. We're going to use his diary. So his diary's written in a prison cell. So we need to find a way of being with him in loneliness in this period so that we can play his words over it. So that's why I obviously did the kind of, you know, the sparse reconstructions. I realised that visually they would run out of road. So I needed another visual format in order to explore that. I had no experience whatsoever of animation.
Yeah.
I'd never worked with it before. I'd seen the work of the guy that I hired on a very, very simple little kind of promo thing he had done for BBC Northern Ireland, celebrating a BBC music season. And I just felt, my God, that really looks cool. It looked very young, BBC Northern Ireland, which is why I noticed it. And I just thought, look, diary, voice, imagistic, I need various tools here to make this film cinematic, to rise above a kind of just simply interview and archive piece. So that drew me the animation, and the guy who did the animation I think is fantastic. And on the next film I'm going to be doing, there's an element of animation going to be involved in that. The music, I was just conscious of one thing. I didn't want to have an Irish soundtrack, of
yeah.
course I didn't. And I'd worked with a French composer a couple of times, whose work I loved, and he'd done a film that I'd been involved in that was mainly set in South America, a documentary, and then he'd done the soundtrack for Jump, a feature film he'd produced, and I'd worked with this guy before, and when I was doing a kind of early couple of teaser reels when I was raising the money, I got him to write a few tracks for it. So some of the key tracks that are in the film were written almost 18 months, 2 years ago. But then we only came to do this full score really starting in about September of this year when the cut was starting to come together. And then I went to Paris a couple of times. And I just love working with Bernie Swell. He's fantastic. And he, as a French guy, there's something about the French, which the French... The hunger strike was a big story in France. There's a sense of the French against the British in the way that there's a sense in the Irish against the British. So whilst his English isn't perfect. He really resonated with the kind of themes of the film and knew what I was trying to do and was very, very diligent about trying to find the kind of emotional temperature upon which to put a score. And then we worked with it and we worked through all the various tracks, and in the end, obviously, we created a soundtrack which, you know, feels, I hope, very different than what you might expect for a film about a hunger striker. But I think, and I agree with you, there's something about the music in the film that I think is another element, a bit like the animation, which helps rise it to another level beyond TV.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It feels very of its time. It has lovely sort of disco-y type scene themes into it, then more somber as it goes on. And it just feels very, you know, pertinent to that.
And modern. Period. It's modern. It's very modern. And I wanted a modern touch to a historical-based narrative.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Yeah.